43 degrees, partly cloudy in Seattle. Tonight, we expect a low of 38. Windy and rainy overnight. Learn about the place where ducks walk on fish this afternoon at 4:35. KUOW 94.9 News and Information. Bernard Ouellette, 206. Actor B.D. Wong reads the short story Boys, a Story of Two Brothers by Rick Moody at 2:20.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Jeannie Yandel. If you've been paying attention, you've likely encountered comparisons between our current economic crisis and the Great Depression. Now, those comparisons may not be accurate when you look solely at the country's financial situation, but the stories people told then can still have contemporary relevance. Sandy Siafi is a local filmmaker. Her latest film is the documentary Sweet Crude, about the battle for crude oil in the Niger Delta. She and some of her crew were actually held prisoner by the Nigerian police during the making of that film. Sandy also teaches film at Seattle Central Community College, and she's been thinking about three Depression-era films, Sullivan's Travels, Gold Diggers, and It's a Wonderful Life, whose messages and themes have particular resonance today. I started by asking Sandy about the 1941 film, Sullivan's Travels.
It's been named one of the most important movies of all time, et cetera. It's by the filmmaker Preston Sturges, and it's one of my favorite films. And I think a lot of people don't know that the most contemporary reference to Sullivan's Travels was in the movie Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, the Coen Brothers film. Actually, the main character in Sullivan's Travels, named John Sullivan, who's a filmmaker, wants to propose to producers. So the setup is this. He's a very successful comedy director, and he brings in big box office. And the producers and studios love him for it. But he goes to them and says, you know what? I want to do something relevant in my life. I want to do something with meaning. I want to look at poverty. I want to look at what's happening in the Depression. In his desire to make this meaningful movie and make this pitch, is trying to sell the producers. And he said that the title of his new piece would be, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And in terms of his desire to get inside the character, he decides to go on what is an odyssey. And this is, after all, a takeoff on Gulliver's Travels and the writer Jonathan Swift. And he proposes that he become a hobo. And he actually wants to get inside the life of the hobo. So some of the themes that are explored in Sullivan's Travels are as universal as it gets and as contemporary as it gets. Because if you want to examine the life of poverty and the life of deprivation, the very people inside the story who live that life are saying to him, oh no, don't examine it like it's some kind of story. I know the story. You don't want to come live that story. That's not the way to learn about it. In fact, why don't you just please go ahead and keep making me a funny movie? I'd prefer it. So the assertion that the main character and Preston Sturges ends up making by the end of the film is that don't belittle entertainment for entertainment's sake, but by the same token, there's something very important about never forgetting that if you jump inside a life that isn't yours, your guest pass expires. And truthfully, that's a lesson that's not lost on me this year. I mean, I, as a filmmaker, in some ways relived that story myself. And when I rewatched scenes from this film, I was struck again by how potent it is. And I think that it would be an incredible day to sit there and watch Sullivan's Travels, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And then for fun at the end, the Simpsons episode where they play with the themes in the scenes. Because, of course, the Simpsons always do the best job of media examination and cracking you up. So to me, that would be a really fun party. A party where everyone just sits still, of course, you know. But you could mix all the cocktails that are in both films. It would be really fun.
Well, you talked about, Sandy, the relevance that Sullivan's Travels had for you just finishing your own film. What relevance do you think Sullivan's Travels holds for people who aren't filmmakers, for me or somebody else who's watching this film for the first time?
There are so many ways, but I'll stick with probably what I would say is the number one way. That because the main character, who is a storyteller, and he, on the upside, he's taking his responsibility as in society as a storyteller very seriously. And the question for the 20th century in terms of art in many ways was, what is your role when you're witnessing something? And the relationship of that filmmaker in terms of witnessing versus manufacturing a tale is really critical. Now that we have a society that is so unbelievably drenched in images of suffering, and yet those images don't much move us to anything anymore, you ask yourself, I think, whether or not telling the story of the everyman hobo that he was thinking of telling, whether that would actually move you to action or it would actually make you more paralyzed and overwhelmed by just the amount, the sheer amount of suffering. For me, the relevance is to re-examine all the questions the film asks, not to decide that it has the answers.
I'm talking with Sandy Siafi. She's a local filmmaker, and she teaches film at Seattle Central Community College. We're talking about Depression-era films that have particular relevance today. And the next film is a musical made in 1933, the film Gold Diggers. Why? First of all, what is this movie about?
Well, Gold Diggers of 1933 was based on a play that actually first, I think, hit Broadway in 1919. And it's best known as a Busby Berkeley musical, and that's a whole category that is really important to talk about, because I was inspired to look back at these films because of an article that Frank Rich wrote in last Sunday's New York Times. And I thought he made a fantastic point about the contemporary film Slumdog Millionaire. That's a terrific fairy tale for our time. And what Frank Rich was referring to is the ending number, which is a big Bollywood production, really harkens back to the Busby Berkeley big, huge Hollywood numbers. And it's really this look at money, of course, art and commerce and the tension, and in some ways, a story that would have even more relevance today than it did then.
In what ways is it relevant today?
Well, I would say that when I, you know, you have to do your cheat sheet of looking back at scenes, and luckily YouTube provides that opportunity. So I went back and I looked at some of the musical numbers. For example, one of the most famous is Where in the Money? And it's this very big Hollywood production, and for the time, quite sophisticated. And for the time, the art direction is stunning, and there are actually women dancing with big, huge coins. And the entire backdrop is money. And it's a sort of lavish example of saying, hey, money obviously is driving everything, but it's never the point. Even though it drives whether or not you get to make the point, it isn't the point. And it's sort of an ironic piece, because the gold diggers themselves are actresses. And while they aren't really gold diggers, everyone around them thinks that they are. And in truth, they all end up sort of luckily with money, but they only end up with money because in many ways they weren't really seeking it all along. I mean, they're really seeking their art. So that's kind of put simply. But some of the musical numbers themselves for film in the time were quite something. So not only were in the money, but there's this this piece called The Parade of the Forgotten Men. And when you watch it, you can't believe how much the black and white photography strikes you, because you see human faces in a way that I don't think you can often see them when you're watching something that's in color in HD. It's just different. The grain really strikes you. And for all the really intelligent things that have been said about the difference between black and white and color, I think in a really simple way, it's faces. It's always about faces. And in this one musical number, there's this parade of forgotten men that are on breadlines and are in the war. So you've got a combination of the Depression and both wars that you're in between that are really being looked at. And obviously in 1933, they're not anticipating World War II yet. They're looking back at the horrors of World War I. So I think The Parade of Forgotten Men and Where in the Money, for me, are two of the pieces that not only do I think are relevant today, but I think they have a new relevance that I couldn't have imagined until it was 2008. I mean, if I had seen it a year ago, it wouldn't have struck me in the way it strikes me now. Hmm. People are in some ways on breadlines again. And certainly while the Great Depression is becoming sort of fashionable right now, and that can get perverse very quickly, I do think it's important to remember why the art, the writing and the photography, for example, of what was called the FSA or the Farm Security Administration, that's quite something when you consider that the new administration may do a version of a new deal where you're actually paying artists again to make work. And, you know, before we get too romantic about that, the government owns the art, and it's not maybe the version of art making we're currently accustomed to. But I see the images in all three of these movies, the black and white photography, and they remind me very much of photographers like Dorothea Lange and Walker Evans. And those images are iconic and really important.
I'm talking with Sandy Siafi, and she's a local filmmaker, and she also teaches film at Seattle Central Community College. We're talking about films made in or around the Depression that still have relevance today. And the final film that you wanted to talk about, we should say, wasn't actually made during the Depression era.
That's right.
The Frank Capra film, It's a Wonderful Life.
Yes, and of course, Frank Capra, as a filmmaker, is one of the major filmmakers of Depression films, and many of his films are as iconic as it gets. But you can't help but say It's a Wonderful Life right now. I mean, my God, George Bailey, Bailey Savings and Loan. I mean, the story is about helping poor people afford homes, and it's about whether or not your regular everyday life has more value than money. There's an idea for something to think about this holiday season. And I also think that, you know, all the answers to life in some ways are in the movie in the very end. You know, the very end is stacked. It's kind of like a baseball game where you see all these things and they take a long time to unfold. And then all the action just goes bam, 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 bam. I mean, obviously, you can't help but love the movie. And to go back to those FSA photography images, when you think about the classic image from the film of Jimmy Stewart holding his children and the light that's on him, which in the business is sometimes called a special, and the glow, sort of almost angelic glow around him, that image almost is directly the migrant woman and that the Dorothea Lange image that's quite famous. It was actually a series of six images, but the most famous is the close-up of the migrant woman with the children around her. When I held the frames next to each other, I went, whoa! And it's that sort of thing where artists of an era are obviously influencing each other greatly. And, you know, when you watch George Bailey in that final scene, it's this assertion that this person is the most important person in some ways in his village, simply because he worked hard every day and he cared about other people. I had forgotten that a key part of the story is that George, along the way in his life, keeps subjugating his own personal dreams because of life circumstances that mean he has to help someone else or an entire community. And I got thinking that, you know, the formula for most contemporary movies is that the hero has some kind of dream, vision, and against all odds, they follow it, including sometimes sort of the roadkill of other people along the way. And I was thinking how to look at this movie in a contemporary context, you have to ask yourself if austerity might mean that it's a more communal vision again, that it makes you a better person and more of a hero if you're perhaps willing, you know, he had a dream to build skyscrapers. And in some ways, inside the context of when this movie was made, you know, that runs, say, up against Ayn Rand, it runs up against the Fountainhead. Here's a man who puts that away and ends up doing pretty mundane things to save his community.
Well, Sandy, thank you very much for coming in and talking with me.
Oh, thank you so much.
Sandy Siafi is a Seattle-based filmmaker, and she's also a professor of film at Seattle Central Community College. And we talked about three films that have relevance today that were made in or around the Depression. And those films were Gold Diggers, Sullivan's Travels, and It's a Wonderful Life. And we'll actually have a full list of other Depression-era films at KUOW.org. You can also listen to Sandy talking about the making of her own most recent film, Sweet Crude, in the KUOW archives. Just search for film or Sandy. Sarah Waller produced this interview. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Jeannie Yandel.
Actor B.D. Wong reads the short story Boys by Rick Moody next. 20 minutes past 2 o'clock.
Next time on Peace Talks Radio, scientists are studying how we might train our brains to feel less fear and more compassion.
If we take the time to pause and reflect inwardly, we actually have the opportunity to take automatic brain responses and open them up to new possibilities so that our personal lives will be deeply enriched.
The Neuroscience of Compassion, next time on Peace Talks Radio.
That's Thursday afternoon at 2:30. 94.9 KUOW FM, Seattle. KUOW 1340 AM, Tumwater, Olympia. 43 degrees, partly cloudy in Seattle. We should see a low overnight of 38 degrees, windy and rainy. Forecast for tomorrow, Wednesday, a high of 42 degrees, breezy and rainy, and in fact, rain is in the forecast for the rest of the week. Looks like we're back to normal.
I'm Jonathan Goldstein, and this week on Wiretap, negative scanning. It's the art of managing to find something wrong when everything seems to be going fine. It's about not being able to wear your favorite shirt because it has a pen dot. Not enjoying your wedding day because the guy at the corner store doesn't like you. We hear from people who are trying to break free and be positive. That's this week's Wiretap from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 8 o'clock. Still ahead this hour, highlights from a rare recording of a Mendelssohn violin classic. That's at 2:40. But first, in a style reminiscent of Virginia Woolf's The Years, Rick Moody's poignant story Boys uses stream of consciousness and repetition to chronicle the life of two brothers from birth to adulthood in a brief but rich narrative. From WNYC, actor B.D. Wong reads Boys.
Boys enter the house. Boys enter the house. Boys, and with them, the ideas of boys. Ideas leaden, reductive, inflexible, enter the house. Boys, two of them, wound into hospital packaging. Boys with infant pattern baldness, slung in the arms of parents. Boys dreaming of breasts. Enter the house. Twin boys, kettles on the boil. Boys in hideous vinyl knapsacks that young couples from Edison, New Jersey wear on their shirt fronts. Knapsacks coated with baby saliva and staphylococcus and milk vomit. Enter the house. Two boys, one striking the other with a rubberized hot dog. Enter the house. Two boys, one of them striking the other with a willow switch about the head and shoulders, the other crying. Enter the house. Boys enter the house speaking nonsense. Boys enter the house calling for mother. On a Sunday in May, a day one might nearly describe as perfect, an ice cream truck comes slowly down the lane, chimes inducing salivation, and children run after it. Not long after which, boys dig a hole in the backyard and bury their younger sister's dolls 2 feet down, so that she will never find these dolls, and these dolls will rot in hell, after which boys enter the house. Boys, trailing after their father like his is the second coming of Christ Almighty, enter the house, repair the basement to watch baseball. Boys enter the house, sight of devastation, and repair immediately to the kitchen, where they mix lighter fluid, vanilla pudding, drain opening lye, balsamic vinegar, blue food coloring, calamine lotion, cottage cheese, ants, a plastic lizard one of them received in a Christmas stocking, tacks, leftover mashed potatoes, Spam, frozen lima beans, and chocolate syrup, in a medium-sized saucepan and heat over a low flame until thick. Afterward, transferring the contents of this saucepan into a Pyrex lasagna dish, baking the Pyrex lasagna dish in the oven for 19 minutes before attempting to persuade their sister that she should eat the mixture. Later, they smashed 3 family heirlooms, the last, a glass egg, intentionally, in a 2.5-hour stretch, whereupon they are sent to their bedroom until freed, in each case 13 minutes after. Boys enter the house, starchy and pressed shirts and flannel pants that itch so bad, fresh from Sunday school instruction, blonde and brown locks, respectively, plastered down, but even so with a number of cowlicks protruding at odd angles, disconsolate and humbled, uncertain if boyish things such as shooting at the neighbor's dog with a pump-action BB gun, and gagging the fat boy up the street with a bandana, and showing their shriveled boy penises to their younger sister, are exempted from the commandment to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind and thy neighbor as thyself. Boys enter the house in baseball gear. Only one of the boys can hit. In their spikes, in mismatched tube socks that smell like Stilton cheese. Boys enter the house in soccer gear. Boys enter the house carrying skates. Boys enter the house with lacrosse sticks. And soon after, tossing a lacrosse ball lightly in the living room, they destroy a lamp. One boy enters the house sporting basketball clothes, the other wearing jeans and a sweatshirt. One boy enters the house bleeding profusely and is taken out to get stitches. The other watches. Boys enter the house at the end of term, carrying report cards. Sneak around the house like spies of foreign nationality, looking for a place to hide the report cards for the time being. Under a toaster? In a medicine cabinet? One boy with a black eye enters the house. One boy without. Boys with acne enter the house and squeeze and prod large skin blemishes in front of their sister. Boys with acne treatment products hidden about their persons enter the house. Boys standing just up the street sneak cigarettes behind a willow in the Ellis's yard, wave smoke away from their natural fibers, hack terribly, experience nausea, then enter the house. Boys call each other retard, homo, geek, and later, necklace thug, theater fag, and enter the house, exchanging further epithets. Boys enter the house with nose hair clippers, chase sister around house, threatening to depilate her eyebrows. She cries. Boys attempt to induce girls, to whom they would not have spoken only 6 or 8 months prior, to enter the house with them. Boys enter the house with girls efflorescent and homely, and attempt to induce girls to sneak into their bedroom, as they still share a single bedroom. Girls refuse. Boys enter the house, go to separate bedrooms. Boys, with their father, an arm around each of them, enter the house, but of the monologue preceding and succeeding this entrance, not a syllable is preserved. Boys enter the house, having masturbated in train station bathrooms, in forests, in beach houses, in football bleachers at night under the stars, in cars under a blanket, in the shower, backstage, on a plane. The boys masturbate constantly, identically, 3 times a day in some cases. Desire like a madness upon them at the mere sound of certain words, words that sound like other words. Interrogative, reminding them of intercourse. Beast, reminding them of breast. Sects, reminding them of sex, and so forth. The boys are not very smart yet, and as they enter the house, they feel, as always, immense shame at the scale of this self-abusive cogitation. Seeing a classmate, seeing a billboard, seeing a fire hydrant, seeing things that should not induce thoughts of masturbation, their sister, for example, and then thinking of masturbation anyway. Boys enter the house, go to their rooms, remove sexually explicit magazines from hidden stashes, put on loud music, feel despair. Boys enter the house worried. They argue. The boys are ugly. They are failures. They will never be loved. They enter the house. Boys enter the house and kiss their mother, who feels differently now they have outgrown her. Boys enter the house, kiss their mother. She explains the seriousness of their sister's difficulty, her diagnosis. Boys enter the house, having attempted to locate the spot in their yard where the dolls were buried 8 or 9 years prior. Without success. They go to their sister's room, sit by her bed. Boys enter the house and tell their completely bald sister jokes about baldness. Boys hold either hand of their sister, laying aside differences, having trudged grimly into the house. Boys skip school, enter house, hold vigil. Boys enter the house after their parents have both gone off to work, sit with their sister and with their sister's nurse. Boys enter the house carrying cases of beer. Boys enter the house very worried now. Didn't know more worry was possible. Boys enter the house carrying controlled substances, neither having told the other that he is carrying a controlled substance, though an intoxicated posture seems appropriate under the circumstances. Boys enter the house weeping, and hear weeping around them. Boys enter the house embarrassed, silent, anguished, keening, afflicted, angry, woeful, grief-stricken. Boys enter the house on vacation. Each clasps the hand of the other with genuine warmth. The one wearing dark colors and having shaved a portion of his head, the other having grown his hair out longish and wearing, uncharacteristically, a tie-dyed shirt. Boys enter the house on vacation and argue bitterly about politics. Other subjects are no longer discussed. One boy supporting the Maoist insurgency in a certain Southeast Asian country. One believing that to change the system, you need to work inside it. One boy threatens to beat the living shit out of the other, refuses creme brulee, though it is created by his mother in order to keep the peace. One boy writes home and thereby enters the house only through a mail slot. He argues that the other boy is crypto-fascist, believing that the market can seek its own level on questions of ethics and morals. Boys enter the house on vacation and announce future professions. Boys enter the house on vacation and change their minds about professions. Boys enter the house on vacation, and one boy brings home a sweetheart, but throws a tantrum when it is suggested that the sweetheart will have to retire on the folding bed in the basement. The other boy, having no sweetheart, is distant and withdrawn, preferring to talk late into the night about family members gone from this world. Boys enter the house several weeks apart. Boys enter the house on days of heavy rain. Boys enter the house in different calendar years, and upon entering, the boys seem to do nothing but compose manifestos for the benefit of parents. They follow their mother around the place, having fashioned these manifestos in celebration of brand new independence. Mom, I like to lie in bed late into the morning watching game shows. Or, I'm never going to date anyone but artists from now on. Mad girls. Dreamers. Practicers of black magic. Or, a man should eat bologna. Sliced meats are important. Or, an American should bowl at least once a year. But these manifestos only apply for brief spells, after which they are reversed or discarded. Boys don't enter the house at all, except as ghostly afterimages of younger selves. Fleeting images of sneakers dashing up a staircase, soggy towels on the floor of the bathroom, blue jeans coiled like asps in the basin of the washing machine. Boys as an absence of boys. Blissful at first. You put a thing down on a spot, put this book down, come back later, it's still there. You buy a box of cookies, eat three. Later, three are missing. Nevertheless, when boys next enter the house, which they ultimately must do, it's a relief. Even if it's only in preparation for weddings of acquaintances in boyhood. One boy has a beard, neatly trimmed. The other has rakish sideburns. One boy wears a hat. The other boy thinks hats are ridiculous. One boy wears khakis, pleated at the waist. The other wears denim. But each changes into his suit. One suit fits well. One is a little tight. As though suits are the liminary marker of adulthood. Boys enter the house after the wedding, and they are slapping each other on the back and yelling at anyone who will listen, "It's a party!" One boy enters the house, carried by friends, having been arrested after the wedding for driving while intoxicated, complexion ashen. The other boy tries to keep his mouth shut. The car is on its side in a ditch. The car has the top half of a tree broken over its bonnet. The car has struck another car, which has in turn struck a third. Everyone will have seen. One boy misses his brother horribly. Misses the past. Misses a time worth being nostalgic over. A time that never existed. Back when they set their sister's playhouse on fire. The other boy avoids all mention of that time. Each of them is once the boy who enters the house alone, missing the other. Each is devoted and each callous, and each plays his part on the telephone over the course of months. Boys enter the house with fishing gear, according to prearranged date and time, arguing about whether to use lures or live bait in order to meet their father for the fishing adventure. After which, boys enter the house again, almost immediately, with live bait, having settled the question. Boys boast of having caught fish in the past, though no fish has ever been caught. Remember when the blues were biting? Boys enter the house carrying their father. Slumped. Happens so fast. Boys rush into the house, leading EMTs to the couch in the living room where the body lies. Boys enter the house. Boys enter the house. Boys enter the house. Boys hold open the threshold. Awesome threshold that has welcomed them when they haven't been able to welcome themselves. That threshold which welcomed them when they had to be taken in. Here is its tarnished knocker. Here is its euphonious bell. Here's where the boys had to sand the door down because it never would hang right in the frame. Here are the scuff marks from when boys were on the wrong side of the door, demanding. Here's where there were once milk bottles for the milkman. Here's where the newspaper always landed. Here's the mail slot. Here's the light on the front step, illuminated. Here's where the boys are standing as that beloved man is carried out. Boys, no longer boys. Exit.
Boys by Rick Moody, read by actor B.D. Wong. Highlights from a rare recording of a Mendelssohn violin classic next. 239.
This is Eric Glass of This American Life, and here's some voicemail we got from a listener.
I travel quite a bit for my work, and whenever I get into a rental car, I tune all of the FM stations to the public radio station, and the off chance that the next person who gets in the car, that they'll stumble into This American Life.
Radio that's fun enough to force onto unsuspecting strangers, This American Life.
Saturday mornings at 11 o'clock. 94.9 KUOW, news and information. 45 degrees, partly cloudy in Seattle. We expect an overnight low of 38, windy and rainy. Forecast for tomorrow, Wednesday, a high of 42, breezy with rain. Rain forecast for the rest of the week.
Now is a great time of year to donate your used car, truck, boat, or other vehicle to KUOW. You'll help support KUOW's quality programming and qualify for tax benefits at the same time. It's easy. Just call 888-KUOW-CAR before December 31st to make a tax-deductible donation of your used vehicle. Or donate online at KUOW.org.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 2:40. How one local woman is working to change child care policies around the world at 2:50.
94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Dave Beck. Savvy classical music lovers can easily whistle along with the familiar melodies of the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto, but a new recording of this favorite violin piece may take you by surprise in a few places.
Thank you. So, Gavin, this music that we're hearing is a kind of cornerstone of the mm-hmm. classical music repertoire.
Very much so.
But this is not exactly the concerto that we've come to know.
Yeah, if it sounds about 95% familiar to you, that's because this is an early version, the first draft that Mendelssohn wrote of this concerto in 1844. And a year later, he made a few revisions, nothing too major, but you could hear in that passage that we started out with, there's a few little downward swooping flourishes that didn't make it into the final version. And a year later, in 1845, Mendelssohn came up with the second and supposedly definitive version, which is the version we know today, the one that's published, the one everyone plays, except for Daniel Hope, who has made this new Deutsche Grammophon recording of the first version.
Yeah. Why would he even be attracted to the first version of the piece?
Just because it's such a familiar piece and such a wonderful piece, and it's interesting to trace Mendelssohn's second thoughts, to find out what his original ideas were, and then to try to figure out why he changed it, why he didn't like it, what were the inadequacies of the first version in his mind? To try to get into Mendelssohn's head and imagine what he was thinking, I think is interesting as a listener.
Yeah.
To figure out why he thought these passages needed improvements, why he changed the little flourishes we heard at the beginning, why he wrote something else. A lot of the changes in the concerto have to do with orchestration. There's little tweaks here and there. He took out winds, put winds back in. Hmm. Occasionally, there's the one major change is in the first movement cadenza, and which he radically lengthened for the second version. In the first version, which we'll hear now, we have just there's just about 12 bars of arpeggios which lead back into the main theme. And a year later, Mendelssohn decided he wanted to give the violinist a little more show-off time. So he expanded this passage. But in Daniel Hope's version, it's interesting to hear what Mendelssohn had in his first draft.
Yeah. First draft of the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto, a new recording of that featuring the violinist Daniel Hope, and our music critic Gavin Borchardt is here to review this new recording with us. So what are your thoughts on why he might have changed it? I mean, I remember he worked with a sort of famous violinist of the day. I wonder
He did. And I mean, he knew from the start that the concerto would be very idiomatic for the violin. He didn't want to write something awkward. He wanted to write something that could be played with a great sense of confidence and a great sense of flourish. Ferdinand David, if I'm remembering right, is the name of the violinist that he worked with. And he worked very closely, and they traded passages back and forth. And Mendelssohn was always asking for improvements and suggestions and asking him, is this awkward? Can you play this? How does this sound? So he was really bent on writing a piece that could come off with great panache. And I think a lot of what he did in the second version was really to pump this up. I mean, he would rewrite some of the violin line an octave higher to make it more brilliant. Huh. Changes like that. And, of course, to lengthen the cadenza. Just to make it even more of a show-off piece. Because he worked so hard on making this piece just as brilliant and as satisfying to play as he could.
Yeah. This recording is full of all sorts of violin fireworks, mm-hmm. including mm-hmm. music that Mendelssohn was writing when he was very young.
Yeah. The concerto comes from later in his life, but his first one of his first masterpieces was the octet, which he wrote when he was just 17 years old, and it's really an astonishing piece in its craftsmanship, in its beauty, and its excitement. I think one of the reasons Hope puts it on a CD is because the first violin part of this octet is just about as difficult as the concerto. It's a very brilliant kind of showpiece for the violin. It tends to be kind of one solo line and seven accompanying strings sometimes. And he really took this opportunity to take this piece of chamber music and kind of point up the solo vehicle qualities that the piece has. Yeah. But it's really exciting to hear it.
Felix Mendelssohn Octet for Strings, and the first violinist in that group of eight string players is Daniel Hope, who's featured on this new recording that's being reviewed for us by our classical critic, Gavin Borchert. The other aspect of this recording is some of the Mendelssohn songs without words.
Mm-hmm. This was a genre that Mendelssohn wrote quite a bit in. There are several dozen short piano pieces, miniatures, that he called songs without words, to indicate their very lyrical content. They're almost like Lieder in the Schubert or Schumann tradition, except, of course, they're for solo piano and not a singer. But Daniel Hope has taken three of these songs without words and transcribed them for his instrument and piano. And On Wings of Song is the one that we'll go out with. And it's, again, they make very, very lovely little miniatures, whether the pianist's right hand is playing the tune or a violin is. They work beautifully both ways.
The Mendelssohn Violin Concerto, the first draft of this piece, the Octet for Strings by Felix Mendelssohn, and some of these songs without words, featured on a new Deutsche Grammophon recording. Daniel Hope is the violinist. Reviewed for us by Gavin Borchert, a composer and classical music writer for Seattle Weekly, joins us regularly on the program. Gavin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Tuesday, April 29th, 2008, KUOW 94.9. I'm Dave Beck.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Jeannie Yandel. There are four countries in the world that don't offer paid leave to new mothers. They are Swaziland and Liberia in Africa, Papua New Guinea, and the United States. Kristen Rowe Finkbeiner wants to get the U.S. off that list. She runs a national advocacy organization called MomsRising.org, and she lives in Kirkland. And as a working mom, Kristen didn't pay a lot of attention to childcare policies around the world. And then she had to quit her job. Kristen, what happened? Why did you have to quit your job?
When I had my son 12 years ago, and he's a healthy boy now, he was born with an immune deficiency that caused him not to be able to be in childcare with other kids. And I have to say, I was born with a NOW sticker, National Organization for Women sticker, on my baby onesie. And so I had thought that the fight for equal rights was over, that we had won, and I was shocked when I had a child and found out how close we are to the edge when you have a child with special needs. And that really got me started.
You said it got you started. What did it start you on?
I started researching. I'm a numbers geek, and don't ask me what possessed me, but one day I was sitting at home with Connor as an infant, holding him, patting him on the back, and I called the U.S. Census. And I picked up the phone and I said, "Excuse me, how many full-time moms are there right now in the United States?" And they said, We're sorry. We don't track how many full-time moms there are because they don't make any money. Try the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So I called them, the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Same question, same answer. And then I started getting curious because this was my first indication of the total invisibility of mothers in our nation. The U.S. Census data is used to track where transportation systems are put in. It's used by businesses to figure out where to put businesses, where to site new businesses. It's used to figure out how many government entitlement programs are needed. So this invisibility has a huge impact on mothers. And in fact, in Canada, our neighbor to the north, there was a whole movement sparked just by one woman refusing to answer the census when they came to her door because she was a full-time mom of three kids and there was no space for her on that census. There is now space for her on that census in Canada. There is not yet in the United States. So after that, I just kept researching and I felt like I had pulled on a little string of data and I was curious. I kept pulling and pulling and I found out more and more information, which ultimately led me to find that the barrier to modern women's equality is really motherhood. It was at that point that I think I had just found out that women without kids make 90 cents to a man's dollar, women with make 73 cents to a man's dollar, and single moms make about 60 cents to a man's dollar. And realized also that over 80% of American women have kids by the time they're 44. So this is impacting a huge portion of our nation. And really was feeling like the unfinished business of the feminist revolution is motherhood. And so I wrote an article. It did not get accepted because it was way too long. But I then kept writing and ended up writing many other articles.
But what was the culmination of this research into what you called some big unfinished business for the feminist movement? Where did that end up for you?
Well, at one point, I turned in a piece to Ms. Magazine, which is now owned by a completely different group than was then. And they assigned me a story. And it was a fabulous story. It was to interview Madeleine Albright, who at that point in time was the top woman ever serving in our U.S. government as Secretary of State. And she had just stepped down from Secretary of State. And importantly, she was a stay-at-home mom with three young children for many, many years, and didn't get started in her paid professional career until she was 39 years old. And so I was very intrigued by writing about that. So I wrote about her and about Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who also similarly was a full-time parent for many years and still succeeded, and turned it in. And then the powers that be rejected the article on the basis of motherhood was not a feminist issue, which for me was really a wake-up call, having been raised in by feminist women and really being sort of curious about, wow, you know, this issue is impacting a huge majority of the people in our nation, and we got to tackle it someplace. And I was just shocked that the place to tackle it at that point wasn't, Ms. Magazine. The article, I will say, did get picked up by Mothering Magazine, and there were articles written about the article being rejected. And shortly thereafter, not my fault, Ms. Magazine folded and has a completely new ownership and staffing.
I'm talking with Kristen Rofinkbeiner, and she runs an advocacy organization called MomsRising.org. And we're talking about how that organization came to be and why Kristen started it in the first place. You've mentioned your family now three times and being raised by strong men and women. And I'm wondering about the women in your life. Who were these strong women that you keep referring to?
Well, it really goes back to my great-grandmother, who was living in Rochester, New York, at the time when Susan B. Anthony was also in that area. And my great-grandmother was the first president of the Rochester, New York Planned Parenthood, in a time when doing things like Planned Parenthood was not very popular. My grandma tells stories of the priests coming and banging on the door and just really being upset. And, you know, at that point, family planning was not done by the majority, was not accepted by, you know, the majority of the citizens. So it was really a more radical act. So then my grandmother actually followed my great-grandmother into that presidency. And my mom also was really active in the feminist movement in the 70s when I was born, you know, in the late 60s. So coming from that background, I really had always had this sense, A, that we need to leave the place that we are, whether it's, you know, the living room or your nation or your world, a little bit better than we found it. That, you know, we have a duty, a civic duty, that if we're going to be on the earth, we need to spend some time making it better, or at least keeping it as good as it was when we arrived. And B, that the barriers to equality are there to be broken down for all people. And I was shocked because I had this sort of false sense of security that we had reached a degree of equality more than we actually had. So coming from this strong line of women, I sort of thought that, you know, my great grandma and my grandma and my mom took care of it. And then when I had kids myself, I was somewhat shocked and a bit dismayed that it wasn't quite the case. And, you know, took the family values, so to speak, that I was brought up with and, you know, tried to make it a little bit better for everybody else and me.
Well, that's something that I'm wondering about. So now, ultimately, who are you doing this for? I mean, is this just so your own work life is a little bit easier? Who are you doing this for?
My husband would say, no, I work too much. But my kids might, too. But really doing it for all of the moms in this nation. And to really just going back to what my great-grandma and my grandma and my mom taught me, which is just, you know, to leave the place a little bit better than you found it. And that was just repeated over and over to me, even from public restrooms to public policy. You know, it's got to be a little bit better than when you got there. And this is, there's such a clear path and a clear need, but a clear path to solutions here that, you know, not only me, but a lot of other moms are working for this. And dads, too. We actually say anybody with a belly button can be involved because, you know, everybody has a mother.
As I'm listening to this, it also occurs to me that you're doing this for children as well. A lot of the policies that you're talking about changing have as much of an effect on the life of a child as they do on the life of a mother or a father.
Exactly. And I always feel like a sorry Michael Jackson song when I say this, but, you know, the children are actually our future. They are the economic engine of our future. They are the leaders of our future. And if we don't invest in raising healthy children, well-educated, and well cared for children, then we are not investing in our own future. So there's a lovely campaign that's going on with another organization, Take Back Your Time, called What's the Economy For Anyway? That I always think about this, you know, what is the economy for if we can't raise healthy children? So definitely for children.
Well, Kristen, thank you so much for coming in and talking with
me.
I really appreciate it. Kristen Rofinkbeiner is the co-founder of the national advocacy organization, MomsRising.org. She lives here in Kirkland as well. And you can learn more at KUOW.org. Search for Moms and you'll find a link to MomsRising.org there. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Jeannie Yandel. Tuesday, October 7th, 2008.
Well, tomorrow's New Year's Eve. You know what that means. It's the time of year when the media tries to define the most significant news of the year. But what about the news in your life in 2008? What did you gain? What did you lose? We'll be talking about that tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock. You can tell us about your year right now by calling our feedback line at 206-221-3663. 206-221-3663. The news of your life, 2008, tomorrow afternoon at 1.
It's a new year. Need a fresh financial start? Well, you could resolve to pick up every penny. It does add up.
It's $1,013 and something cents.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. Meet a family of penny pinchers, literally. Next Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
That's a lot of pennies. That program, Sunday afternoon at 1. KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle. KUOW 1340 AM Tumwater Olympia. 45 degrees, partly cloudy in Seattle. Overnight, we expect a low of 38, windy and rainy. Tomorrow, Wednesday, a high of 42, breezy with rain expected. And we've got rain in the forecast for the rest of the week. Looks like we're getting back to normal. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 3 o'clock. The latest headlines from NPR coming up in a minute.